Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Aura Walker with us. She's a clinical hypnotherapist, a vocational counselor, therapeutic facilitator, and a group leader, and a motivational speaker. 2006, a one-year postgraduate certification in clinical hypnosis at the renowned Hypnosis Motivation Institute in Tarzana, California. And she's got one heck of a background. Aura, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much. Hypnosis. What, you know, we've heard so much about it. What actually is hypnosis?
Hypnosis is a natural brainwave pattern, and everybody goes in and out of hypnosis all day long. As long as the brain is active and it's hasn't stopped, then everybody goes in and out of hypnosis. And what it is going from active mind, which is a rapid brainwave pattern, into a lower brainwave pattern. Say if somebody doesn't eat lunch and is working through lunch, then they're automatically going to dip down into a slower brainwave pattern that is called alpha. And then if they just take a nap in the afternoon and they're just relaxing before they sleep, they're going into theta. And so induced hypnosis can be done through deep relaxation and accessing those alpha and theta brainwave frequencies and helping people to access their subconscious. It's very interesting and intriguing, and it's getting a lot of exposure.
I imagine it's been around for a long time. The Hypnosis Motivation Institute, what is that? What is that like? What does that, is being trained there set you apart from anybody else?
Yes. I decided to go there because they're the only federally accredited program in the world. And the Kappas family established it, I believe, in the 60s. It goes way back. John Kappas was the founder, and then his son George Kappas now runs it. And it's an interesting history. John was interested in doing something different with his life. I think he'd tried many different careers, and then he was hired through some friends in Hollywood to do a show, probably one of the first reality shows. I think it was way back in the 60s or 70s, that was to be staged hypnosis. And he found that to be really kind of dry and boring. And so what he wanted to do was actually do real hypnosis. And so he actually started to study it over, you know, decades and mastered it and then opened a school. And he was one of the founding pioneers to really open a school and teach people how to do it clinically. And then his son continued on from there. And they do have accreditation. They're very strong about teaching ethics and working with counselors, and pretty much the people who go there who succeed are people who have a background in mental health already.
Okay, so in essence, somebody can go to school there and get, is it a degree, is it a certification, what is it?
They have all different levels. They have classes just for the heck of it. You can go and take a class and try it out and see what it is and learn more about it. And then you get like a little certification in knowing what hypnosis is, or you can do more and gain levels of professional know-how or certificates. And then the one-year certification is in clinical hypnosis. You get it's basically a one-year postgraduate certification undergraduate certification. But, you know, anyone can do it. But definitely having a background in psychology helps because you're working with the public, and I certainly don't take that lightly, and I don't recommend that somebody just off the street learn to do it, because those are the people that often fail because they don't know what they're doing. So it is working with people's minds, and, you know, you don't want to get in a situation that you can't handle with someone, for example, with PTSD, which is one of my specialties. So I take it very, very seriously.
No, I imagine you do. Now, so working with this now, do you work with people? I know you, I see you're from Los Angeles. Do you work with people outside the state? How does somebody get to you to work with you?
You know, I'm starting, it's been a little bit of a journey, but since I started my hypnosis practice, I've been a mental health counselor straight out of graduate school since 1995, so I've worked doing mental health counseling for many years, but hypnosis was really the clincher where I noticed that people with trauma were responding very rapidly within 12 to 24 hours. Sometimes they were reporting huge changes in their lives, and these were people with, say, 54 years of domestic violence, abuse, childhood abuse, car accidents, war trauma. There's something about trauma lodging in the central brain where those people were reporting really significant changes very, very rapidly. And so when I noticed that and I started my practice with that, that's kind of how I honed in on trauma. I started to advertise sort of, you know, with agencies that worked with trauma and then networked with them and got some responsiveness. And now I'm expanding that with service people and veterans. And so there are agencies up with me online, and I have yet to travel, but there's been some talk of going and maybe training people who work with soldiers, because what I do and the technique that I developed for trauma is very teachable. So one of my goals is to teach people who work in refugee relief camps and who work on army bases and maybe in the field actually, you know, in the Middle East or wherever the wars are going on.
Yeah, do you know that old adage that it's a small world and you never know who you run into? Where? You know, and go ahead and ask me what I was doing in 1976. Ask me.
What were you doing in 1976?
Funny you should ask that question, Aura. Somebody by the name of John Kappas and his brother Alex taught me hypnotherapy.
Oh, my goodness. There you go.
I went through HMI when they were in Panorama City, way before they hit Encino. As a matter of fact, I taught the basic class there.
Oh, great.
Yeah, small world. I know. A lot of years have gone by. But I knew John personally. I knew Alex personally. Is Jay Bartel still running around?
You know, I don't know. It's been a few years. I may have taken a class with he or she. I don't know. There were many teachers.
Yeah. By the way,
all of them good.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I didn't know his son. I didn't know John's son, but I knew John personally. I knew Alex personally. That was way back when, and it's a great field, and it's a field that helps a tremendous amount of people. That's a matter of fact.
Absolutely. So I'm preaching to the choir.
Oh, you bet you are. I ended up becoming a stage hypnotist, and I ended up, I spent a year in the West Indies on cruise ships entertaining. When I got back, my agent said to me, he said, if I get the gig for you, and I said, great, you got Hawaii. He said, guess again, Alaska. So I went to Alaska with three or four other guys, and we were entertaining, came back, fell in love with Alaska, went to Alaska. I have no idea how this happened, but I fell into radio in 1982, and I've been doing that ever since. But if it wasn't for the hypnosis and hypnotherapy and then on to the stage work, I would have never gotten here. So we wouldn't be talking today.
That's amazing. That is amazing.
I
feel
Dubai
a little bit like now I'm under a spotlight.
No. I know this is great. I've studied it, obviously, haven't been actively involved in it for years, but it's been a lot of years since I've done it and I've actually practiced. But it's always there. You never forget. And John Kappas and who you learn from, where you learn, you don't learn hypnosis that way. I mean, there was a very specialized way that they taught, and it worked and was effective. And those two guys made a dent in the world when it came to therapy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've kind of run with it in my own direction, but they really understood the subconscious and the conscious, the 10% and the 90%. They really broke it down into a manageable understanding for me and very simple, and that's how I explain it to people. I also like the metaphors of the hard drive of a computer. I really think the mind works very much like a computer. I think what they did was just really open up the ability for people to help people in a very short period of time. And when I was coming into graduate school was when managed care was coming up, and the head of my department said, if you have 30 minutes with someone, what are you going to do? And I found that hypnosis just works really well for short-term therapy.
Sure, sure, no question about it. And what they basically did, they turned it into working with the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system, the autonomic nervous system, and that's really where it's, that's really what you're dealing with when you're dealing with hypnosis. But he tied it in such a way that people have expanded with brain chemistry and everything else from that point. But I think they were the, quote-unquote, the first ones on the block that really had a handle on what to do. And anybody trained in those methods, plus when you go out and you do your own, there's a very specialness to that.
Yes, and like I said, the thing that I really liked about the school was that they emphasized ethics in practice, and they had a class on ethics. I think there are a lot of schools out there now, and California has a reputation of being on the cutting edge in terms of healthcare. So there's all kinds of holistic and alternative programs all over the place. To me, I think they don't mean as much unless they have that ethics background and training as part of the program itself. You have to have that, and HMI did have that.
No question about it. And they had the hypnotist union and so on and so forth. They had to go through three levels. One was hypnotist, then the master hypnotist, and then the certified clinical hypnotherapist, or the hypnotherapist. And there were psychologists on staff, and you obviously, when somebody would come in, they would sit down with the psychologist, and then it was referred from there. I think business and professional codes, what was that, in California, 2908, was it? This is going back a while. But it was, if you were going to work with somebody, it had to be under the direction of a medical doctor, psychologist, psychiatrist, etc. And I don't know if it's still that way, but that's the way it was. You had to be referred if you could work with someone, and that should still really be the same way.
Yeah, I think the laws have changed a little bit. Really, the legal title, and you know, these are all just legal hoops that you have to jump through, but the legal title is vocational counselor. And that keeps people out of trouble. You're not allowed to say that you're licensed because there is no license. It is a certificate. It's a training. So that's why I say certified clinical hypnotherapist. But there are definitely guidelines, and I am a union member because the union really watches out. And it's not like a union like the Teamsters where they force corporations to, you know, pay them or else. It's really a union that just backs the hypnotherapist, and if a hypnotherapist gets targeted, you know, indirectly or for malpractice that just seems really unfair, then the union comes up and really stands by them, and I think that that's great. I mean, that's really great when you're in a practice that is, you know, based on ancient stuff, but is really still making its mark in the world and really carving out a space. I mean, you know, 100 years from now, it's going to be commonplace because, you know, we're tapping into the brain, and it's really something that's been around since the beginning of time. It's just that now there's a field that's being created around it.
Now, by the way, we're starting to run out of time. Aura, do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes, it's www.aurawalker, hypnotherapy, hypnotherapy.com. So it's
wonderful.
My name, AURAWALKER.
By the way, have you got a book or anything coming out?
Not yet. I'm hoping to do more TV. I do have an MP3 on my website that uses a milder version for the public through recording for stress, anxiety, and trauma release. And people around the world are reporting to me that they're getting good results with it. So that's really pleasing.
I'm going to tell you a funny story. I'll put a smile on your face as you leave. People would appreciate this, but you, as a hypnotherapist, would really appreciate this. When I left HMI, I started my own school of hypnosis and hypnotherapy. I actually got certified by the state. So I'm up in my office one day. It's in Encino, and obviously the Los Angeles area. And there was a woman with me, and we were going through a session. And we got about halfway through the session, and the building started to rock. we were going through an earthquake. You know, obviously you're not going to get her up. You don't know what's going to happen if you scare her. And so each time that I would talk to her, I'd say, go deeper, and the building would sway back and forth. When we finished the session, I didn't tell her there was an earthquake. She got up, and she looked at me, and she said, that's the best session we ever had. Anyways, with
awesome.
That,
you made it work for you. I like that.
Yeah, at least. Okay, and by the way, thank you so much for being with us. Good night.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains, jungles, and desert oasis. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there? When there are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. So many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Michelle Rickman with us, the author of 101 Great Ways to Enhance Your Career. And we're going to do the job tip of the week. But this week, we're going to take my profile, destroy it, shake it around, and make me actually look good. Hey, Michelle, how are you?
Good. How are you tonight?
I'm good. I'm ready to look good.
You're ready to look good. Okay.
I'm ready to look
so
good.
Last week, we started talking about LinkedIn profiles.
Yes.
And as promised, we were going to take a look at yours and then see what we need to do to get you marketed more appropriately on the web.
get me looking good. Okay, here we go. All right, now, I have a profile on there, but it doesn't really say a whole lot.
Ah, well, that's the first thing I was about to say. when we take a look at your profile, it doesn't really tell us very much about who Michael Ray Dresser is.
Aha.
So that would be the first thing that we'd want to address. when we take a look at your header, the first thing underneath your name, it says Dresser After Dark. But of course, unless we're actually following you, we don't really know what Dresser After Dark is.
Aha.
So this is really the place where we want to brand you, right there, right under where it says Michael Ray Dresser, and say who you are professionally. So that if somebody is searching for you, whether it's for current business purposes or if you were in job search mode, that would be the first thing that they'd see. So instead of it saying Dresser After Dark, we may want to say, whatever you feel best defines you at this particular point in your career.
Mm.
So what would that be in your mind?
Are we talking about a value proposition, or are we talking about define me? Okay, I'm a radio talk show host. I'm a communication specialist, and I don't know if this should really go on a profile, but that unique selling proposition. I've done over 30,000 interviews on radio, so there's not a lot I haven't heard. Yeah.
Perfect. So, what we would probably want to start with is underneath your name, we would say radio talk show host and communications specialist.
That doesn't sound too exciting, does it?
Well, not initially. But then as we go in further to your profile, we get a little more personal.
Okay.
So your summary is very, very short. So currently we have really a one-line summary that says 27-year veteran media professional skilled in communication. You know, it's very, very short. What I want to see there when I'm developing a profile is really information about who you are. So now I have a copy of your bio, which really tells me a lot more information, things that I wouldn't know from looking at your LinkedIn profile, things such as the fact that you lived in Alaska for several years, how your career developed in talk radio, some of the different types of venues that you've worked in, the types of people that you've interviewed. This would be the place where you would want to say how many interviews you've actually done, because you know this is the part that's really going to be unique about you. And also talk about your media interview training. So that would beef up your summary.
I got
start really
it.
No, to develop
I got,
your
no,
profile.
I'm quiet. I'm listening very closely to you. I'm thinking back and forth. Did you hear any of the interview that went on right before you?
Just a bit. Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I don't usually put this in a bio, but the way my background for becoming a talk show host, I was a stage hypnotist.
And that's an interesting talking point. So yeah. That is certainly something. It may not be, let's say that you were in job search mode or you were putting together an executive bio, for corporate purposes.
No.
It may not belong there, but for LinkedIn, it's very appropriate because you never know. Somebody may be searching for, you said that you did hypnosis and hypnotherapy.
Yeah.
Somebody may be searching for that in conjunction with talk show radio. So when you've got those keywords in your summary, talk show radio, talk show and hypnotherapy, somebody that might be specifically looking for those two qualities will find you because it's going to increase how you show up in a search.
Yeah. Well, no, that makes sense. So really, we want as much as we can get in there. Yeah, but
yeah,
we don't,
yeah.
If we say that, then if I have to tell the truth, that I have to say I started that 35 years ago, and I would have to tell them I was like 3 when I started. Okay, no good. I tried.
Which is okay, if that's what it is.
I was tall for my age. Okay,
it
just happened to come up. The interview right before you was a hypnotherapist. I was looking at her resume, and which was interesting. It turned out where she was trained, the guys, the both of the creators of the place had passed away. But I'm listening to her, and I realized where she was trained at. The guys who had that school that created it were the two guys that trained me, and that was a long time ago.
Interesting.
Small world.
Now, the difference between a LinkedIn profile and a resume is, resumes have, I hate to use the word rules because there really aren't any hard, fast rules, but there are certainly standards where a resume today, you really don't want to go back more than 10 to 15 years. Not so necessarily in a LinkedIn profile because the more that you've got in your profile, the more places that you can connect. So, for example, when I'm looking through at your experience, again, we're a little skimpy. I don't really know where you've been. So
Michelle, half the time I don't either.
Okay. So as we build people's profiles,
It's good to have all the companies that they've worked in, because those are companies that we may be able to connect with, past colleagues that we may be able to find on the internet. So the more that we can beef that up as well, the more it's going to help somebody, particularly if they're in a job search mode.
Now, by the way, Did you see the bio that's up on the website?
I have. I'm not on the web right now, but I do have the one which talks about born in Chicago and living in Milwaukee, and the evolution and of your career.
So really, there should be more there then.
Absolutely.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
Well, I can't hide anymore.
No. And LinkedIn is not the place to hide, because, again, as we talked about, whether you're in job search mode or you're looking to, bolster your business or to increase revenue or sales or whatever it is that you're using LinkedIn for, it's all about being found. So the more you put yourself out there, the more probability of people actually being able to find you.
Okay. Now, here's a question. I'm on Twitter also. And if you took, and on Facebook, but if you took Twitter, if you took Facebook, you took LinkedIn, is there a different emphasis for each one? Does each one accomplish a different thing, or do you stay the same with all of them?
Each one has their own specific personality. LinkedIn is very much a business networking venue. So it is. It's for searching. It's for connecting. It's for creating relationships. It's definitely got a different twist to, let's say, Twitter, where it's a little more quick, more of a soundbite.
Yeah.
LinkedIn is pretty comprehensive. You'll find more information about a person on a LinkedIn profile than you will on Facebook or on Twitter.
Okay, so LinkedIn's going to be more of a business profile.
Correct.
Okay, all right. Twitter's kind of the short, quick, get it done. And Facebook, I don't even know how to define Facebook.
Well, Facebook is evolving. So, and I have to say that the venues that I work with, LinkedIn is definitely where I do most of my work, so I wouldn't call myself an expert on Facebook. But it's becoming more popular now in the business arena for having fan pages, for having business pages, and getting the business out there in that regard.
All right, now, let's say somebody comes to you cold.
For both social and for business.
Ah, okay. Now, somebody comes to you cold. I know we're playing with this, but you still have given me a lot of great ideas here. But somebody comes into you cold. What do they bring to you? Is there a worksheet that you work with somebody to get out the best of them? How do you work with somebody when they bring you in as their the guide to do so?
When somebody's coming to me and they say that they want a LinkedIn profile, 9 out of 10 times, if I'm doing a LinkedIn profile, it's in conjunction with a resume package. So I will utilize the information that I get from the worksheet that I provide. I provide all of my clients a worksheet. I do a phone interview, and I use old materials that they have, such as an old resume, an old CV, old performance evaluations, whatever it is that they happen to have floating around. And I would take all of that, filter it, and then create their resume and their LinkedIn profile. Now, again, a LinkedIn profile is not a cut and paste of a resume, but I would use a good chunk of information that would be on the resume, plus some additional, more personal information, because it is the place where you can put a picture, you can put interest, you can put hobbies, you can put organizations that you may not that are, may no longer be appropriate to be on a resume, such as, you know, like a fraternity or a sorority or something that's, for somebody that's in their 40s, it's a little outdated for them to have that on their resume, but it is an okay place, an okay piece of information to have on a LinkedIn profile. If they're just coming to me for a LinkedIn profile, then I have a not as comprehensive a worksheet as I do for the people that I'm doing the resumes, but still I do, you know, have a fact gathering tool that I use in order to, you know, get what I need in order to create a profile.
Okay, now we're starting to run out of time now. The website we can find you at.
Sure, that is Ricklan Resources. That's Riklan Resources.com. And all of my information about creating LinkedIn profiles and the service that I provide with that is right there.
Now, by the way, the 35-year-ago stuff with me, that's between you and I. We don't tell anybody.
Not telling a soul.
Thank you. I feel better now. I'll see you next week.
Okay.
Okay, good night.
Good night, Michael. Thank you.
I can only give you love that lasts forever. And the promise to be near each time you call. And the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime. And a hand to hold the leaves begin to fall. And a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'd be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore. For now and evermore. Now that's all.
A dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. I know the man.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Jackie Ottman with us, the author of The New Rules of Green Marketing, Strategies, Tools, and Inspiration for Sustainable Branding. Jackie, an ardent environmentalist since childhood, pioneered green marketing by founding J. Ottman Consulting. Her mission, apply her blue-chip consumer packaged goods expertise gained at top New York City ad agencies with a creative bent for dreaming up new products and her finely honed strategic instincts to help businesses develop and market the next generation of products designed with sustainability in mind. Jackie, hi, welcome to the show.
Delighted to be here, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. When we talk about sustainable, you know, we've heard the word so many times, Jackie. When we are dealing with a sustainable product, sustainability, what is it that we're actually dealing with?
Well, we're dealing with products that use resources more sparingly, like energy, water. We're also dealing with products that have less toxics. And we're also dealing with a broader issue of social issues. So those are what's called fair trade products, products that, like coffee, cocoa, for example, that the producers pay their workers a living wage. So it's a very broad definition, sustainable.
Okay, now when we're dealing it, there are so many, and I've looked at your press release here, and I think it's really good the way we bring some things out. Myths, there are so many people who do not get what green really means. You know, you go back to, if it's a green product, you're going to sit under a tree and, you know, make funny sounds. But it's not that at all. It has to do with the sustainability of living. It has to do with as the energy that we use today gets so expensive, the things that we use today actually wreck the environment of what to replace those things with. So some of the myths that we are dealing with as consumers out here, what are we talking about?
Well, you raise a very good point, very insightful, Michael. Sustainability is not about necessarily saving the planet. The planet's not at risk. The planet's always going to be here. Really, we're like the next endangered species on the list as human beings. So when we talk about sustainable consumption, sustainable products, and marketing, what we're really talking about fundamentally is preserving our way of life. Is if you really like the stuff you have and the car you drive and the pool in the backyard, and you want your kids and your grandkids to have that and go on for many generations, then we need to be much more careful about how we use resources. And the good news is that the technologies for a lot of these things exist. We in the marketing world are trying to figure out how to serve this all up to consumers so that they don't feel like they're trading off today to preserve a way of life for tomorrow.
Jackie, one of the big problems that I see, and let's use the auto industry for a moment, we'll see the plug-in cars, the electric cars, the hybrid cars, which are all well and good, but you may spend $20,000 more for that particular automobile than you will with a standard automobile. And I think one of the problems that most people have, and for the most part in their head, is that it costs too much to go green today.
Yeah, well, that's one of the myths that I dispel in the book. Some products do cost more. That's because some of them have special ingredients. Sometimes it's economies of scale. But more and more, thanks to advances in technology and growing amount of scale, as nearly 83% of Americans claim to be some shade of green, the prices are coming down. And in some instances, like buying a compact fluorescent light bulb, let's say, where it might cost more than an incandescent, it will save you over the cost of the car. Over the cost of the light bulb. Sorry. Now, speaking of cars, if you pay a couple of $1,000s more for a Toyota Prius and you drive it enough, if you're, you know, got a long commute like a lot of people these days who are moving further and further away from cities, you'll get that benefit back in gas savings over time.
Do you think that, and the question, because I've thought about this for quite a while, and especially in marketing, that obviously making something presentable enough and desirable enough to have to own, would it have been smarter for the people who started to move the green products into something that was tangible and workable? Green obviously has taken on a different definition. We just talked about that. But to keep it still green, you know, in many people's heads, green has got a stigma to it. And the problem with that is that's not what green is about at all.
Well, that's right. But, you know, thanks again to technology, design, the Method Company, do you know Method out in San Francisco? They market a full line of household cleaning and personal care products through Target and a lot of Whole Foods and a lot of other retailers. They put design front and center, so people want to have that container of hand soap. I mean, they want to have that broom, that mop, because it's just cool.
Yeah.
That was what was the difference between the Toyota Prius and General Motors EV1 that came out in the early 90s was the Prius had this really beautiful, sexy silhouette that turned Hollywood on. But the EV1 was just a dopey, clunky car. I think the Nissan Leaf is going to do well, partly because of the design and the cool factor.
Now, by the way, you said the magic words, and I've been around for probably 150 years now, but the one thing that has stayed constant, that one something that would trigger a buying response, you just said it, that's cool. That has been around since, my goodness, the 40s, and that's that if somebody looks at something and that comes out of their mouth, they buy it.
Right. Well, that's the big difference between the green movement of the 1970s and the 80s, when things were, you know, the crunchy granola folks, the hemp-wearing hair shirt kind of gang, and today's green consumers. Green is popular and mainstream today because it is cool. It is the kids, the young kids, the millennial generation, which they're calling Generation S, grew up with this topic in school. So they'll chastise their classmates and friends for, you know, not having a refillable water bottle or not recycling or creating a mess or what have you. They'll chastise them because the cool kids are doing the green stuff now.
It's true, and I really believe it's just, well, let's go back with another term, the term nerd. You know, if you go back 10, 15, 20 years, the term nerd, you meant somebody who was socially inept and so on and so forth. The nerd today, you get that title, and, I mean, that's going to make you money. I mean, that's something proud
of. Oh, absolutely. So, you're going to come up with the next million-dollar app.
Absolutely.
Sure. I mean, in the green movement, we have G diapers. The mothers love this diaper with this outside, really wonderfully colored terry lining and things because it's cool. It's kind of like making a fashion statement.
Yeah.
There's a product that I talk about in the book called the Watson Energy Monitoring Device. I mean, who would have thought 20 years ago that if you had a little device on your coffee table, it would be a conversation piece? And this, what this device does is it tells you how much energy your home is using. I mean, in the old days, what'd you do? You put the electric meter out in the back or down in the basement. Whoever watched the electric meter. Now this is cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, let me tell you what I'm still getting over. I don't drive a car. I drive a computer. And it got OnStar. And one thing shocking about OnStar is they're out in space somewhere, right? And they can tell you how much tire pressure you have. So realistically, there's not too much that we can't do today. And I really believe that it's going to take people like yourself that are actually marketing and letting know people what green really is and dispelling a lot of the myths. Because if we don't move into that direction, you're right. It's you and I as the human beings that may not be on this planet. So the key is to be able to say it in a language that people understand. And that, I think, is the key.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What got you involved with this? In the very beginning, when you, besides the marketing experience that you've had and the background that you've had, why green? What was it about green that
Well, you know, I kind of stumbled into it. I was still in the advertising agency business, and I was doing research on consumer trends that would be hot in the 1990s, this is in 1988, hot for consumer goods marketers, and just really serendipitously landed on the environment. And then I started to research air and water and solid waste. And I said, gee, these are really serious problems. And I could tell that the environment was a you can't get there from here issue, that in order to really tackle the problems, we were going to have to reinvent the way we met consumers' needs. And at the time, I was planning to go off on my own as a new products consultant. And I said, why not put two things together, new products and green? So now I'm a new products consultant in the green world, and if anyone has a new product, they come to me to help them launch it.
Yeah, one of the let's throw out a name here, and you've got it in your press release, and I think it's important. Walmart, of all people, going green. Walmart, you have this feeling, this idea about Walmart, but Walmart is a lot bigger and a lot stronger than most people think, and they're starting to go green too, aren't they?
Right, but their green is a very pragmatic kind of green. They know that if they can get their suppliers to reduce packaging, there's less waste that they can pay to get rid of. If their vendors come up with a more efficient form of a laundry detergent, they can pack more boxes on the shelf. And they also know that If they, and this goes back to your earlier point about green products costing more, well, Walmart knows that many green products actually cost less or can save consumers money. So they know that if they can educate their consumers to buy more greener goods, guess what? They're going to have money to buy other things in Walmart, and they'll, come back time and time again.
No question about it. But when we really come down to it, do you think that this transition for us to really get green, really get strong with this, do you think that's going to happen in the next 5-6 years? Because it's going to, like anything else, it doesn't just slowly happen. It slowly starts, and then somebody gets the idea that this works, and it spreads like wildfire. When do you think it's going to really click?
It's a good point. Frankly, things have slowed down in the recession like they have for so many other product categories. Luckily, certain kinds of green products have held up, like organics, for example, where there's an inherent health benefit. But I think things aren't, you know, things over the course, I've been doing this 22 years, and just in the time span that I've been doing this, you see the green movement kind of go, you know, two steps ahead and then one step back in the recession,
yes,
and two steps ahead and one step back. But slowly but surely, we're, you know, to the point where we are mainstream. I think it's going to catch more like wildfire when the current generation of millennials are much more in control, because, you know, we all hold on to those habits that we, you know, proverbial speaking,
sure,
acquired in kindergarten. So this is the generation that grew up with this. So I think,
yeah,
they'll really, you know, put on the step up on the gas when they get into power.
And they're going to be in power very shortly, I think, the next 10, 15 years, and then it'll move from there. That's if we have a planet. I mean, we got to throw that factor into the mix also. But when we come down to it, the sustainability has become a word that's almost, it's like every household is beginning to understand this word, and more people are looking at the economy now and looking at what they can't have, and they're starting to become self-sustaining. And if you become self-sustaining, you have your own gardens, et cetera, moving away from cities, then you get more and more green prone. And I really believe that that's what's going to do it. The worst off we get, the more green we're going to get, because we're going to get forced into it.
Sure, sure. I think another thing that's going to help all of this, Michael, is when people get more of a idea of the connectedness of things. You know, there's a reason why we had a especially rainy summer, why the temperature's heating up, why the hurricanes are getting worse, why the mudslides are getting worse and everything. And so I think when people start to put these pieces, why people have allergies, that are the allergy season is starting 2 weeks ahead of time these days because of global warming. So I think when people start putting the pieces together, they'll start and they'll make a connection between what's going on globally and their personal lives, then we'll get a lot of traction.
By the way, in marketing today, and one of the things you talk about, and it's very important, I think it's a critical issue to take a look at, to bring to the table, why is saving money taking the place of saving the planet on the green marketing pitches today? Very true. Save the planet has in and of itself its own definition, and it gets a little quote-unquote airy-fairy with a lot of the people who were behind it and pushed it. And save money now sounds right because there are so many green products available out there. It's not just there's that one or two or three that are standing ahead of the crowd and that's what everybody's standing in line for. Green,
right,
green products, green marketing today is part of the normal marketing because there's so much green there. There's so much sustainable product out there that it's just becoming part of our everyday living.
Exactly, exactly. But I'll tell you another reason why the saving money is important. Got to remember that, and I always remind my clients of this, is that when consumers go into a store, a person goes into a store, they're wearing their shopper hat. They're not necessarily wearing their citizen hat. I know, you know, some of this is merging now, but they've got a shopping list and they've got a budget. So they don't buy, you know, this is kind of almost a cliche in my field right now, but they don't buy laundry detergent to save a planet. They buy laundry detergent to get the clothes clean. So
yeah,
if you can buy Tide cold water that'll get your clothes clean and save you money, then it's a win-win and someone will buy it.
And that makes sense totally across the board. We're starting to run out of time. Jackie, where can we find you? Website?
Oh, thank you. It's very simple, www.greenmarketing.com.
And also, too, can we buy the book there? Can we find out more? And in addition to the book, how does somebody bring you in as a marketing consultant?
Terrific. Thank you for asking. At the website, greenmarketing.com, there's information about the book. It's also available at Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble and all the bookstores. And if you go to the website, you'll see the different services we provide, and I'm happy to work with clients who are, you know, genuinely trying to come up with a greener product and reach these green consumers and try to understand what motivates them and develop new products. So my contact information is right there on the website.
Wonderful. Hey, Jackie, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Thanks, Michael. Okay, bye-bye.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a loving burning light will warm the winter night. Well, that's all. Well, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return here, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you'll adore from now and evermore. Oh, that's all. Oh, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world for a toy. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore. Yeah, it's me that you adore.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Diana Bora with us. She's the author of Creating Personal Presence, Look, Talk, Think, and Act Like a Leader. She's CEO of Bora Consultants, a communications training firm. Her clients include 9 of the 10 largest corporations in America and 140 of the Fortune 500 companies. She has won several awards, including the Star Quality Award for IBM, a Vendor of the Year for a Year Award for Frito-Lay, and the Lifetime Achievement Award from ASTD Dallas. And let's say, Diana, I welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about this word called leader, define what a leader is, especially in business. We've taken the term, we've bantered around, we've tossed it around, we've used it, we abuse it. And I truly wonder, Diana, how many people truly understand the definition of what a leader is?
Well, basically a leader is somebody who has followers. You know, a lot of people call themselves leaders and they look behind them and nobody's following them. But
sure,
you've got to be out front on something, whether that's policy, whether it's outstanding ideas, whether it's innovation, but you've got to be in the forefront in some area.
Okay, now, one of the things that you talk about, which I think is completely important, the creating the personal presence, the look, the talk, the think, and even acting like this person that has got to be out in the forefront. Now, that, from what I've seen over the years that I've been around this planet, is a learned skill. Somebody may innately have that strength, and they may have it in them, but isn't there a step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 path to take to truly learn how to do it?
Yes, it's not just the same as charisma or charm or, you know, some of the words that we banter around. it really is something that you learn and that you master. People with presence, they look comfortable, they look confident, they speak clearly and persuasively, they think on their feet well, they act with integrity. So part of that is character. But the other things are just fundamental skills that you develop.
Now, by the way, when we talk about these, I'm going to call them features about someone. Let's look at politics today. Let's look at some of the people who, and not necessarily names, but some of the people who are running for office. They come out, everybody loves them, they're great, they're energetic, they're going to do everything, and then they open their mouth, and pretty soon they're starting to lose in the polls. And my goodness, these are the people who are standing ahead of everybody on this planet, quote unquote. They're vying for the most powerful position in the world, and yet those people that are training them allow them to get out there and make the mistakes that cost them a presidency.
That happens frequently for several reasons. Either they down deep do not embody that fourth category. You know, when you read that subtitle, look, talk, think, and act like a leader, maybe they've been coached in those fundamental skills, but they don't have that fourth component, which is character. And somehow that fourth part surfaces. There's some kind of scandal. They say something off the cuff to someone, and it's not a prepared question that they've been coached on, and they speak from the heart, and they say something that just flies in the face of those prepared statements, and that's when they get in trouble.
Interesting point. It's speaking from the heart. There's that word called integrity. Integrity, for a basic definition, integrity is how you feel inside is what you project outside. You know, there's a matchup. And I guess we've gotten to a place where when we look at leaders, it's like, you know, your kids, quote unquote, today you get thrown in jail for this, but your kid opens your mouth, your kid comes in and you say, tell the truth, and the kid tells the truth and you whack the kid, okay? Well, that's the same thing that happens today. If they tell the truth, somebody's going to whack them, and they whack them because that the definition of that means they won't vote for him. So people today are frightened to tell the truth, even in business, because of popular opinion, which can be devastating in so many areas.
Well, I think that more and more, I would say even in the last couple of years, people are expecting their leaders to say it like it is. They're tired of platitudes and this parental attitude of, don't worry your pretty little head about this. We'll take care of you. You don't really need to know the facts. You don't really need to know the truth. The government up here is taking care of you, or the CEO over here is taking care of you, and just spilling out statements that are really not the truth. And they're expecting to hear from their leaders, this is how it is. Now, granted, they don't want gloom and doom statements, and I think the difference between telling it like it is and gloom and doom is attitude. You know, if you've got to be a leader, you've got to be motivational, or people are not going to follow you.
Sure.
But somewhere in the middle there is the medium, you know, the happy medium, where people are willing to follow you and be motivated by you, but they still want the truth, and the focus is going to be on action and corrective action, not just platitudes.
No question about it. And I think when it really comes down to it, and I'm going to say the word communication. Communication in and of itself can make or break you, because I would, for all the years that I've been around, one of the things that I have learned very simply is what you say can make or break a presentation, a talk, a speech, a sale, or something. But we don't always know that that person that we're speaking to understands what we meant by what we said. So what part of communication could move me into that place whereby people understand me? I'm not just talking to myself.
Right. You know, we always think we're clear. We wouldn't have said things like we did if we didn't think they're clear. So the test of our communication, the test of our presence, is what the other person hears. And there has to be that emotional connection. And that's where the talking and that third component I mentioned, the think, comes through. When you express yourself extemporaneously, you have to listen to what the other person said to you so that you engage with them emotionally and respond appropriately.
Okay, well, what creates the emotion? When I say that, I've got to be able to recognize something, and it's something that's going to benefit me in what somebody says. But what does it create? What is it that creates that emotional bond?
Identifying with their values, identifying with their need. You have to like somebody. If you don't like somebody, you just don't want to identify with them. I mean, that's the reason when you just walk up to somebody in a party and you exchange pleasantries. If you don't feel like you have anything in common with them, you don't have common interests, you don't value the same things that they value, you don't feel like they care about you and what happens to you, you just don't have an emotional bond. And if you don't have that link, then you just don't have a desire to communicate and desire to understand what they're trying to say. And you have difficulty seeing their point of view on anything.
Daniel, let me ask you this. In all the businesses that you've worked with, and you've got a really impressive resume, I mean, there's no question about that. Have you found a kind of an overarching theme, a common denominator where businesses have had problems where you've walked in, you've done your vetting on them, but there's something missing? What is that something that usually is missing in a business?
Well, that's a very broad issue, because sometimes I'm working with individuals and the whole organization. But I think the most common problem is that they don't communicate across functional lines. Everybody is so focused on their job, their mission, their goal, and they just don't think about what the big picture is. And, you know, the people in research and development don't talk to the engineering people, and the engineering people don't talk to the accountants, the financial people, and the financial people don't talk to the salespeople. They just have a hard time getting out of their little sphere. And you see it happen in a family. You know, the parents are so focused on the job and bringing home the bacon that they can't focus on, you know, what's my teenager going through? And the teenager's so focused on, you know, my peers are wanting me to go here and do this. They can't think what kind of financial strain maybe their parents are under. You just see it in every entity. People are so self-focused that they have a difficulty getting outside to see somebody else's point of view about anything.
Now, by the way, I have the book in front of me, by the way. It's a keeper. And I'm on page 122, and this is How You Think. And what it says here, by the way, you've noticed I've memorized the entire book here.
But page 122, great. That's always nice to hear.
It says, tell a good story. What's the purpose of a story? You know, we keep hearing people say, tell a story. What's the purpose of a story?
Well, it's really fourfold. First of all, it gets attention. Like no other. I mean, we like movies, you like stories, you like jokes, and people tell a personal experience or an anecdote, but it's really about making your point memorable. People don't remember statistics, they don't remember data. It's about retention. When you go in to give a presentation, if you're in sales, if you're coaching a soccer team and you need more money from the parents or from a sponsorship in the community, if you're trying to raise money for the health services in your community, whatever it is, to really retain the information, you have to tell a story. If you go in at the C-suite in an organization, it's always about telling a story. If you think about all those CEOs that are out on the speaker circuit, they don't go out and dump information. If you talk about the presidential debates, they don't throw out statistic after statistic. They have a story. You know, I've created more jobs, or I've improved health care in my state, or I've done such and such with the legislation while I was in the Senate. They are telling a story, and it's generally one sentence or two sentences. It makes your point memorable. When you hear the president, the State of the Union, he says, Sergeant so-and-so, he's up in the balcony, stand up, take a bow, and they'll tell a story about this soldier's experience on the battlefield. It makes the point memorable. It's not about you, the storyteller, but it's sure. About helping the audience remember.
Yeah, and I think it was John F. Kennedy, and it was Reagan also, when he was dealing with the people writing his speeches. He said, make them short. You got an audience attention span of 7 to 8 or 9 minutes at the absolute maximum. They'll end up drifting. So he told all of them, Reagan especially, keep the stories, keep the speeches short, keep them to the point, get in, get your point across, tell your story, and get out.
Yeah, if you think about those State of the Union messages, most of them are 45 minutes to 60 minutes, and they've got to tell everything all the miracles I performed this year, everything we're going to do next year, my whole mission, talking about foreign policy, domestic policy, Social Security, all the key issues. And they will generally work in four or five stories about, you know, I was having dinner with this farmer in Kansas, and I was talking to this welfare mom who's having difficulty with three kids, and I'm talking about this soldier that's back from Afghanistan, and they will work in those stories to make their points about the issues, not data, because people can't remember the data.
No question about it. So realistically, and again, we got a couple of minutes to go, but it's a process to get you where you want to go. You know, these people who are the wonderful orators, it doesn't just come naturally. I mean, they can speak, they can do what they want, but there is a system and there's, let's call it a biology, let's call it a science behind what it is you say and how you say it. And better yet, the visual you're going to give someone, what they see when they see you, how you stand, how you move your body, the body language. It's all a big package, isn't it?
Right. And you can't argue. You can't argue with stories. You can argue with facts all day, but you can't argue with a story.
No, I totally agree, because what it really comes down to it, facts and figures don't do it. I think what the story does, it puts it into content, and then it delivers it with an emotional impact.
Absolutely. It's all a package, and you as the person are the package when you talk about your look and how you talk and think and act. It's the story, and you are the embodiment of the story as you deliver it.
Okay, now let me ask you this. We're running out of time, but I picked the book up, Creating Personal Presence, Look, Talk, Think, and Act Like a Leader. I read it page by page, cover to cover. Diana, what do I, Michael Ray, the reader, what do I get? What do I walk away with that I didn't have before I picked the book up?
You have 20 characteristics that you can use as a checklist to see, how do I measure on this scale? Nobody ever arrives. You have personal presence and you master it. None of us will master it by the time we die. But you'll see where you are on that continuum, and you can check it off. And there's even an assessment that you can get to see where you fall short in which of these categories and what characteristics you need to master, whether it's a skill, an attitude, an action.
You know, one of the things that you've talked about here, I want to make a point here. Everybody's been talking about, you know, what a wonderful impact that Steve Jobs left on the planet with everything that he did. But there's one of the talking points that you have, I think, you know, we really have to look at it. People have forgotten how to have a face-to-face conversation. Jobs also was responsible for people not talking to anybody anymore. You know, we text, we email, we do this, we do that. And my goodness, you know, we have forgotten how to do that. And I think that's something
right.
That's a skill that should never leave.
But you can have a presence online. People, you know, it's just words on a screen. It's words on a text, and you still create a personality and impression in people's mind. I've written blogs on that. What is your online presence? You still have a personality that comes through in those word choices.
No question about it. We're out of time. Let me ask you this, Diana. Do you have a website we can find you, find the book, find out what you're doing and what you're about?
Yes, just like my last name, Boo Her. Of course, I hope you don't do that, but it's BOOHER.com.
Never boo you. I think you were a wonderful job, and it's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you, Michael. I love being with you.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see. Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Come and sing a simple song, freedom. Sing it like you've never sung.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Junok Jade Harmon is with us and promoted to Ninth Dan in 2008. And I hope I pronounced that right. Becoming the highest-ranking woman in the Korean art of Kuk-sul-wan. She runs the Kuk-sul-wan of Clear Lake School in Houston, and her husband. Her memoir is entitled The Iron Butterfly, Memoir of a Martial Arts Master, The True Story of a Mermaid's Daughter, and was written with Anna Maria Rodriguez, a faculty member at the Institute of Children's Literature and an award-winning children's science writer. And welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you, Michael. Hi, Michael.
Hi. Did I pronounce that right, June?
Yes, sir. You got good.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, I was worried there for a minute, but we got through it. June, let me ask you this: martial arts. What is martial arts?
Martial arts is
yes.
Self-defense, and you go help the self-defense.
Okay, but it's more than just martial arts, isn't it?
Huh?
Anna, you're there?
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Okay,
yes,
yeah.
I'm here.
Right. Okay, good. Now, but martial arts is more than just martial arts, isn't it? Isn't it a mindset? Isn't it almost a way of life that even besides the physical movements, the practice in life of some of the things that are taught in the martial arts, isn't it a way of living also?
Definitely, that's a way of living, it's a way of thinking, a way of behaving. I mean, you not only practice martial arts when you are in the school practicing your exercises, you take it with you when you step out of the school and you go in the street, when you go to work, when you go home. And it's all about self-respect, respect to others, and self-discipline, and mindset that in this, our particular martial art, that we can do more than we really think we can. It's a very positive mindset that we try to apply not just to our practice, but to everything we do in life, family, work, anything you do when you go out.
Okay, now let me ask you this question. And today we live in a very violent world. It's not the way it was 40 or 50 years ago. There's always been violence, but today especially, for whatever reason that there is, there's a tremendous amount of violence. More and more people have to protect themselves because of people just not being able to deal with life. Now, between a man and a woman, usually a man is going to be stronger. But how can the martial arts help a woman compensate for that strength and help her in a situation whereby her life could be threatened?
Well, in our martial art in Kuk-sul-wan, women learn to use specially joint locks. That's something that you don't need to be especially very strong, and that helps us a lot, at least to break our grip or any hold that a man or another woman can have on us. So we learn special techniques or special movements that allow us to do, you know, what I said, joint locks and other movements that allow us to escape without having to really engage on a physical confrontation.
Okay, now, by the way, with a physical confrontation, with the joint locks, now, is there, I know that we're on the radio, but is there any way you can give us a visual of what a joint lock would look like, an example of it?
Well, let's say, for example, somebody grabs you on the outside of your wrist. And one joint lock will learn is to grab the wrist up and put pressure on the bone that is on the outside of the wrist of the attacker, of the arm of the attacker. If it's well done, with just a little pressure, it inflicts a lot of pain, enough for the individual to let go, and then we can just turn around and leave.
Now, by the way, and it's the turnaround and leave that is extremely important. Well, I would imagine that most attackers, the weaker you are and the less that you that you fight them, the more powerful that they think that they are. And a couple of really good moves placed at the right time in the right place, like what you were just talking about, would let an attacker know that you knew something, which would cause them to stop and think and maybe a second thought about carrying on with their attack.
Yeah, the most important thing is to try to make them let you go. So yeah. Besides joint locks, we also know some other pressure points, specifically that with one sure hard strike, they sense a lot of pain and then let you go too. So the main thing is, no, we don't want to be engaged in any confrontation, but we want to have them release the grip and so we can leave. And also, well, they know that, as you said, we are not just fighting like a cat, you know, with sure. Nothing, not knowing what to do, but we have certain basic movements we have learned that would allow us to defend ourselves.
Okay, now, if I was a woman and I wanted to learn the defense and I wasn't in Texas, now, how much of it can I get out of the book, or do I have to have that one-on-one or in a group? Do I have to have that physical contact to be able to learn?
Well, the best way to learn martial arts is, like with anything, practically, is by doing. So if somebody would like to learn things, definitely there are basic self-defense classes, but martial arts, one of the things that you get from it, one of the benefits is that, learning to defend yourself. But as we said earlier, it gives you much more than just that. You get physically fit if you practice, you get mentally fit, and you have a mindset that, you know, when you get attacked, it's not only, it doesn't matter if you know a specific technique or movement. You have to set your mind to do it. Don't let fear grab you. You have to focus on what you're doing and know what it is that you have to do. To do that in that particular situation, you know, when it's real danger, that's why you practice so much. So those movements come pretty much like second nature to you. You don't have to think, hopefully, well, what is that I have to do that I learn in class? But if you practice repeatedly, somebody has a grip on you, you hopefully will be able to use the right technique almost automatically, quickly, and then get away.
Okay,
but definitely practice is what it works. And by the way, the book is mostly it's about the life experiences of Chinook Harmon. It has a little bit of martial arts and, of course, a lot of her personal experiences in self-defense. But it's much more than that. It might tell all her growing up in Korea and 1956 and beyond, after the Korea War ended, and all those experiences, and clearly shows you why she decided to train in an activity that is traditionally for men, and how she actually reached the highest rank that is for Kuksul.
But let's take it a step beyond that. It wasn't just the martial arts, and it just wasn't the ranking. What is it about her that caused her to move to this level of proficiency at what she does?
When you meet Chunuk, you realize how perseverant and tenacious she is. When she says something, when she decides to do something, she goes all the way. I mean, when she was little, her life was not happy, let's say. She had really a lot of obstacles to reach a happy life. I mean, her family struggled to make a living. She is the youngest of six siblings, and there was extreme poverty, very cold, very hungry, not enough of anything. And when she was 6 years old, one day she decided, I don't want this anymore for me. I'm tired of being cold, of being hungry, and not having mom around, and having to be by myself, and sometimes in not very safe situations. So as she grew up, she wanted to learn something, to find some kind of, you know, education that would allow her to break free from poverty, be self, be independent financially. And what really fulfilled that dream for her, what she found that will help her do that was martial arts. She found that it was her calling. She loved it. The first time she saw it, she said, I can't believe it. These people are doing joint locks, are using weapons, swords, staff. Look at all those. They are very athletic, and that's something that appealed to her a lot. And definitely that's what she focused on. But that was not easy to do it because, of course, Korea, 1970s, women don't do martial arts. That's a man thing. Her mother, her family expected her to follow on the traditional role of women at the time, you know, married, dedicate her life to raise her family and her kids. But that's not what she wanted for her. She didn't want to repeat her mom's life. She wanted something different. She wanted something better. And martial arts gave her the way. And the thing that made her go all the way is that when she was 14, the master of Kuksul said, okay, do you want to practice? But if you do, you have to commit to this for life. This is something you can never stop doing. This is all the way. Martial arts is a way of living. Martial arts is just not to come twice a week and then forget about it. So are you ready for this commitment? And she said, yes. As she said, well, at that point, she was 14 years old. She said, I wanted it so badly. I would have said yes to anything that she asked me to do to commit to that. But actually, she had fulfilled her promise to her master in Korea 40-some years ago. And she had never stopped training, only when she had her two children, and that's about it. And she's still training today.
Now, by the way, even if it was martial arts, it would be something else. What I'm hearing, the real underlying story is redefining what a woman is, redefining self, giving yourself an identity, something to become where there wasn't any choice before. And the message itself, it goes way beyond martial arts, and it goes way beyond Korea and America. I think that's a universal message to any woman in the world right now.
Yeah, that's true. That's what. That's why actually Chunuk wanted to write the book. I mean, she has a tremendous story to tell, and that even in times where things might seem impossible, you living in South Korea, 1970s, I mean, this is something that, I mean, not many women do. Even in the school she was training, there were some, but very, very few women, but they were really, really good at it. And that was an inspiration for her, telling her, well, look, I'm not the only one with this idea of doing something that everybody in my family is telling me that it's not the right thing to do. Other women are doing it, and look, they can get really good at it. So that's something that inspired her, that she wanted to, she thought it was possible. Korea in that time, I mean, it was still hard, but it still, the door was open. And she knew how to take advantage of that and pursue. And actually, if you ever have the chance to look at the videos in our website, or she puts the word art in martial arts when she performs. So she has reached that level of perfection that is really amazing.
Anna, do you have a degree in the field also? Are you a martial artist?
Yes, I'm. Yes, sir. I'm a student of Chunuk and second degree black belt.
Okay. Now, what was that for you? Did you come from, when I say a similar background, not necessarily poverty, et cetera, so on and so forth, but did you come from a similar background whereby women had a certain definition? Did you find your identity through martial arts also?
Well, Not the same, but my family is from Spain, and they emigrated from Spain to Venezuela, where I grew up. Venezuela, about the same time. Chunok and I are about the same age, I think 2 years apart only. But Venezuela is a little different. The way women are accepted, women have more freedom to pursue. There is not really, I don't think it would have been an issue for me to practice martial arts when Chunok had trouble getting her family approving. But for me, martial arts brings something else. I'm also like, you know, I love physical activity. I'm inclined to that. It appeals to me. And martial arts for me offer many more things than just, you know, doing exercise regularly to stay healthy. And after I met her and her husband and other masters in Kuksul, I realized that it's something that I wanted to pursue, that will take me, will give me another level of self-fulfillment as a person. And definitely complements with all the other things I do with my family and when I write my books.
See, and the other side of that is, look at the lives that you get to touch. You know, how many women out there that before they have come in and gone through, you know, the process, how many women out there that was that fear within them, not necessarily the fear of walking into an alley, but the fear of being themselves. And I believe that when you come down to it, when you get into the martial arts, there is a door that opens up that gives you a strength within that it's beyond just protecting yourself in an alley someplace. It gives you that inner strength that you didn't have before, and there's a confidence that goes along with it too. So are there all of those things to gain advantage of within the context of martial arts?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have one of the ladies actually that read the book. She was telling us that before she read the book, I mean, she's a shy person. I mean, her parents had trouble with their tenant, and you know, she was always afraid to go and talk to the tenant and say, well, look, my parents are complaining for this, it's not working, and you're not fixing it. She never did that. She was always afraid, well, not of a physical confrontation, of course, but, you know, just maybe a verbal confrontation. And she said she read the book, and after she knew about the experiences that Chunok has gone through and the way she faced them and the way she, you know, she grabbed courage and definitely faced them face on, and definitely that she knew she could do it and that you can do that. So after she said, I finished the book, and at that time my parents had trouble with something was not working in their apartment, and they said, well, we try to talk to the tenant here many times, and he just doesn't come and fix it. And he always tells her, well, yeah, later, well, you know, the part is not here. And then she said, well, I'm going to talk to them. And her parents said, really? But you're always scared. I said, well, no, I think I'm going to do it. And she told me, at the end, I felt so proud of myself. I went over there, talked to the man, and told him that he needed to go and fix my parents' apartment. And that it might seem like a simple step, but you realize that by knowing about martial arts and by knowing also about people's stories that relate to that, what that they have gone through and how they have overcome similar problems or problems you can relate to somehow, actually will help you to solve your own problems. I mean, you don't have to be afraid to confront a situation. There's always a way to solve a problem. And actually, this person enrolled in martial arts, and she's very dedicated. It's just beginning, but she feels that there's something that has helped her, you know, be more assertive and comfortable with herself, and you know, standing up for herself sometimes.
No question, Anna. We were just about ready to go. We were running out of time. Do you have a website that we can find you at?
Yes, you can go to www.annamariarodriguez.com, and that is annamariarodriguez.com, and it's in your website, so if that's too long, and that you can go over there. You have us listed on today's interviews, and people can click over there. You can find a blog we have written. We have excerpts of the book, and we have a video trailer, so you can see Chunok perform, and also you can check out the book and check all the other things, and definitely visit us over there. We'll love to have you have a comment too.
Wonderful. Ana Maria Chinook, thank you so much, both of you, for being here, and I've appreciated your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say, don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Once upon a time, a girl with moonlight in her eyes put her hand in mine and said she loved me so.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Mike Eisenhart with us. He is the author of Get Empowered Now: Mind, Body, and Spirit Wellness. He's an author, he's a motivational speaker, he's a Reiki master, and he is an actor. And let's say, Mark, I welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so glad to be here.
Oh, great. Thank you so much for being here. You know, when we talk about Get Empowered Now, there's so many people running around this planet right now, Mark, that they're living, well, I won't say they're living, they're running around, they're upright, and they're not quite alive yet. What's it take to get somebody alive, get them empowered, get them moving? What do you do?
Well, it's interesting that you should say that, because, you know, one of the things that I talk about in my book is that, you know, I had stopped living. You know, I had started dying. In fact, in many ways, I had died. You know, my spirit was broken. One of the lines in my book is, on November 29th of 2009, I died, and it nearly killed me. So I would say the advice I would give to everybody, it's ironic, it's going to sound funny, but the single most important thing I did was what the Buddha did. I sat down in a chair and did absolutely nothing but breathe. I learned to be quiet and to be still, and to finally get comfortable with being uncomfortable. You know, we're so busy whipping around at light speed all the time, doing whatever it is we're doing, experiencing what I call the law of distraction, which takes us away from the perpetual present tense, what I call the eternity of the infinite now, because the power is in now. You know, when people ask me what day it is, I say today, and when they ask me what time it is, I say now. So I would just encourage people who want to make changes in their lives to just take a minute and sit and be still and do nothing and just breathe and relax. That was the single most important thing that I did.
Now, by the way, you were 455 pounds. You had 20 states
pounds,
of disease, diabetes,
yeah, high blood pressure. Diabetes, high blood pressure, all that stuff.
And you're down 215 pounds. Now, what was the trigger?
Well, the experience of watching my dad beat cancer to die of liver disease, just knocked me to my knees. I mean, I succeeded brilliantly in running my life into the ground. My dad was my best friend, my hero, my mentor, my true north, you know, still is. And the experience of just watching his weight cut in half right in front of my eyes and become a prisoner in his own body was excruciatingly painful. So I felt powerless over that experience that was happening to my dad. So I exerted a measure of control over another aspect of my life, in this case, ran it right into the ground and succeeded brilliantly in it. You know, I had diabetes, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, anxiety, depression, OCD, and eating disorder, a 90% loss of feeling in both feet from diabetic neuropathy. You know, I was engaging in any behavior that I could get my hands on to distract myself from the experience of the fact that my dad, my hero, my best friend, and my true north was dying in front of me, and there was nothing I could do about it.
Now, by the way, when you hid yourself within yourself, and I think that's really what we're dealing with, because when people hide, you can't go into a closed room, you know, into a room, close the door, sit in the dark. That's not hiding. You can hide whether you're in the middle of 50 million people. When we hide within inside of ourselves, how did you get out? Where was the key to open the door to make that first step?
Well, there was a couple things. I mean, I did at the time, you know, I used to work as a paramedic firefighter. So at the time following my dad's death, I did what all good medics do. I defaulted to what I call my crisis management programming to push me through the initial shock and awe of the fact that my dad was dead. And then on the 28th of November, I did something I hadn't done in about 11 years. I said a prayer. I said it to the spirit of my deceased father. And then I had a complete and total meltdown. I'd been holding my breath this whole time that my dad was sick. And finally, the floor fell through, and I caved in all the way down to the bottom. I was lying in my bed. I was sobbing and crying uncontrollably. I felt like my chest was going to cave in. I just was in horrible, horrible pain. And I said, "Dad, I've lost my way. I need you to get me back on track. I need your help." And so that experience, you know, that finally me letting go and grieving and being present and being still and actually taking the time to open up my heart and cry those tears and feel those feelings was the catalyst that resulted in my life turning around on a dime. That prayer was not only heard, it was answered. But, you know, I was literally white-knuckling it up until that point. You know, just like literally pushing through, like all good medics do, to just get through the next moment without doing something crazy. And then on that day, I decided that's it. I felt safe in my home. You know, I felt safe in my bed, and I just let it all out. And I was hospitalized the next day, and that was sort of the experience that was the camel the straw that broke the camel's back. And it was, you know, hitting rock bottom leaves you with two choices, die or climb. You know, I got to do both as far as I was concerned, and I got to live through that experience.
All right, but then the next step, you live through it.
Yeah.
Where did you see to put your foot on the path to what? What door opened up for you next? What was the next step?
Well, the single most important thing that I did after that, again, was what the Buddha did. It was really in meditation. It was in my willingness to sit and down in a chair and be still and get comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because you have to understand, all the things that I was doing up to that point were targeted at distracting me away from the experience of whatever was going in my body, whatever I was feeling, whatever mood state I was in. And when I got that willingness through a friend that I met in one of my groups that I was participating in, his name is Paul, and he said, "I want you to sit down in that chair and do absolutely nothing." And I'm like, "You're crazy. What's that going to do? You're nuts." Well, but I did it, and then I did it over and over and over and over and again. And the key was getting to my subconscious mind. The problem was in my subconscious mind, and once I got comfortable with being uncomfortable and had that willingness to sit down and be still and just breathe instead of jumping out of that chair and engaging in whatever kind of behavior to distract me from that experience, that's where the power is. That's why I say the power is in now, because now I live in that moment, and I'm feeling my feelings, and I feel my mood states, and I acknowledge them, and I own them, and I don't jump out of them or engage in behaviors designed to distract me from them anymore.
You know, the word nothing is very powerful, because from nothing comes creation. You can create
everything. Something. That's right.
If you come from a place of something, what goes on is you're just expanding out what you already have. And I think people are frightened to death to go to nothing. And nothing is a really good place to be.
That's right. you know, people say, you know, I just can't believe that you did that. What you did is crazy. And I say, no, it's not crazy. I didn't go crazy. I went insane. I went in to get sane. I went inside myself, and I just kept going deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper inside myself. And that's like you say, from nothing comes everything. From the absence of creation comes creation, and that was the moment that changed my life, coming to that truth, that understanding, that point of power. You're absolutely right.
Now, by the way, as you started to drop the weight, down right. 50, down 100 pounds, when you looked in the mirror, what did you see?
Oh, I for a while there, I didn't recognize myself. You know, there were so many times where, you know, I would start and end every day with meditation, and there were so many times where I would listen for that still small voice of what I call Gus, God, Universe, Spirit, and it would just keep reminding me, just take a leap of faith, just keep doing the work. And there were times, so many times, when I looked in that mirror and I'm like, who is this person? I don't recognize you anymore. I had to, you know, really just keep doing it. It was so nice to have an affirmation to be able to see the proof of it working, because I can assure you at 455 pounds, if I had ever thought that I would have dropped 50 pounds, I mean, let alone 215 pounds, there's just no way I could even visualize that. So once I started, you know, looking in the mirror, it worked, and I started using positive affirmations and positive visualizations and just kept doing them over and over and over, and it made just for this incredible transformation.
Now, by the way, how tall are you?
I'm just about 6'1".
Okay, so right where you are right now, if you're about a couple hundred pounds right now, that's a really good weight, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's not an ideal weight for what I want to be doing in the long run, but it's a good weight that I can hold. I fool most people. Most people don't look at me and don't think I weigh 250 pounds. I carry it well. My trainers are doing a fantastic job at Empower Health and Fitness of helping me to create the body that I want to create, because, you know, I am in training to be a pro athlete, and I have some really incredible goals that I want to be doing as an athlete. So I'm really pleased with where I'm at now, but I'm nowhere near where I want to be, for sure.
Yeah, but the point is you know you'll get there now.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that visualization, have you got a, and I know what this is going to sound like, but do you have the body that you want in your head?
No, not yet. I have the body that I want in my head right now.
Okay.
I'm not where I want to be as far as my end game goes, but I have a picture of what that looks like, and I know that's possible.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's where
I was going with that. If you got a picture of what it is, I've been a bodybuilder for probably 50 some odd years now, and I am no Schwarzenegger, but in the way that I work out. But that said, you can go into gyms where they've got Schwarzenegger's picture all over the wall, and you walk in and know unconsciously you're never going to be able to do that. You set yourself up for failure. You walk into a place where they got pictures on the wall of things that you can attain. Yeah, sign me up. I'll join 10 times. But I think that's realistically where it's at. Get that picture in your head of what you know you can do, and you turn around and it becomes.
Right. Well, it's funny you should. I'm actually really glad that you said that. I didn't know that was in your background. And, you know, one of the most important things that I had to do was to free my mind of all that distortional thinking that I used to have that was a roadblock to me really getting to create the person that I wanted to be and the body that I wanted to have. I'm sure that you've heard of the book, The Adonis Complex. I mean, I might as well have written that book. You know, I had this cognitive distortional thinking about what I wanted my body to look like, and if I didn't get to there, it was never going to be good enough. And so now the phrase that I use a lot in my book and in my lifestyle and my language and with my trainers is the imperfectly perfect body. You know, because I realize that I'm getting into the danger zone I swing for the fences every day, but I'm getting into the danger zone if I let that perfectionist in my subconscious mind out again, because that ego that used to work against me will start working against me again. I want the ego to work for me, and I want to find that balance of an imperfectly perfect body for me. In other words, be the best that I can be within the limits of my genetics. I'm still a 42-year-old man. You know, I could train with the best trainer in the world and have an even better diet than I do now, and I'm never going to look like Arnold Schwarzenegger. It's that simple. So I just have to swing for the fences and create the best body and the best look that I can for myself within certain genetic limitations and be happy with that. And that's the intention that I'm holding. That's my goal.
Yeah, now, by the way, in and of itself is a little bit of a limit in there, but I want to talk about the law of attraction for a moment. And the way I...
Okay, good. I'm glad you are.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
The law of attraction for a moment. What created my belief in a law of attraction is I looked around the world and I saw the misery that people were in. I looked around the world and I saw happy people. I saw sad people. I saw all of it. And it all has to do with the law of attraction. If you want it, right. You can have it. You want to be poor? Yes. You want to be wealthy? Yes. You want to be sick? Yes. You want to be healthy? I mean, and the list goes on. So I truly believe in the law of attraction because if you take a look at it, no matter what kind of a mess that your life could be in, and if you look in the mirror, you chose it. So I believe in the law of attraction.
Right. I do too. And I'm actually really glad you came back to that because, you know, that law of attraction, the movie The Secret, has been an integral part of my healing and my journey and my transformation. And, you know, when my dad was alive, he used to say that he wanted to give me a positive direction in life. I did my best to follow it. And, you know, when he died, I don't know if you remember, I said in the prayer, I said, Dad, I've lost my way. I need you to get me back on track. Well, in order to continue to do that, he gave me a guidance system that I call GPS, God Positioning System. It's like the law of attraction, but it's 10 million times stronger. And there's a blurb up on my website, which is www.getempowerednow.com. And I talk about it in my book. And just to give you a real quick example of this, you know, my last name is Eisenhart. So it only makes sense that I can look at someone and then feel my heart space and know whether or not to connect to them. And recently I realized that these connections that I was making to people were happening at times that were synchronous with the master numbers on my numerological chart. Those numbers are 9, 10, 11, 17, and 22. So to give you an example, in one day of when I started noticing that my dad was literally not only continuing to move me in a positive direction, but I was in many ways living the Celestine prophecy because I was making these connections at times that were synchronous with the master numbers on my chart. I was in Columbus, Ohio, and I was walking out of the gym, and I was drawn to the energy of a woman who, after having a dialogue with her, I found out that she works for a company that manufactures electrolyte replacement drinks and who was looking for new athletes to sponsor. And I had just prayed and sent Reiki for that intention, and I looked down at my watch, and that happened at 7:17. Then later that day, I met a guy who owns a supplement company, and he picked me up as a sponsee, and that happened at 11:22. Later that day, I met another guy who was a professional bodybuilder and who has trained many Mr. Olympians and other professional bodybuilders, and that happened at 2:11. So my dad has literally taken the law of attraction and turned it into a kind of energetic orienteering or guidance system. Now,
Mark, let me hold you up. I hate to do this. We're running out of time.
Okay.
So please, one more time, slow with your website.
Yeah. Oh, it's www.getempowerednow. Empowered is spelled with an I, like impulse power. And I just want to say really quick thanks to my dad, my mom, my sister, www.healthforce.com, thefeelgoodworld.com. I'm going to be working with them in Portland, Oregon, and all my sponsors and all the people who continue to support me on this journey. And especially you, thanks for having me on the show. I'm really grateful to be on today.
Oh, take care. And Mark, thank you for being here. Good night.
Okay, good night. Thank you.
As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
Got a funny feeling. We're parting.